For over 40 years, Western Europe, it was argued, was threatened by the Soviet Union. This, of course, was the heart of the Cold War. For the last 2 years, according to some writers, at least on this side of the Atlantic, Western Europe has been threatened again, this time by the United States, led by George Bush. Certainly there has been a crisis, possibly the most significant in the long history of the transatlantic relationship. How serious is it? How deep? If it is deep, what are the implications for world order? And if it is deep, what are its basic and fundamental causes? The Department of International Relations at the LSE has organized 3 lectures this month, next, and in December to explore these problems. On the 24th of November, Francois Heisberg will talk on NATO and its future, or indeed its death. On the 4th of December, Professor Joe Greco from the United States will talk about America and Europe. But tonight, I'm delighted to have my old friend, Professor Guy Lundestad, to set the stage, ask the big questions, and hopefully provide some answers. Guy has had a glittering career, author and editor, I think, of only 10 books, including his most recent, The United States and Western Europe Since 1945. Guy has also coined probably one of the more famous terms in international history and international relations, the notion of empire by invitation. Guy has also been, since 1990, director of the Norwegian Nobel Institute in Oslo, where he's run a wonderful program of Cold War research, and I was privileged enough to be there last year. He is also, of course, the secretary of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, which, of course, awards the Nobel Peace Prize. The list goes on. The accolades could, too. However, with no further ado, I want to introduce Professor Guy Lundestad to speak to the issue tonight, the United States and Western Europe after Iraq, just another crisis or transatlantic drift. Guy, over to you. Thank you very much.
It's wonderful to be here, and thank you, Mick, for that very generous introduction. It almost read like my obituary, but then I know that there is a very special twist to British obituaries, so it was really very kind. Actually, my first serious misunderstanding of the English language was when I thought there was an R in obituary, that we all went into space, or obituary, but I was at Oxford yesterday and gave a lecture, and it's wonderful to see so many of the faculty members here. Some of you I know, and some of you I hope to meet. Even more, it's wonderful to see so many students. I've been to many excellent universities. The faculty members are very good, but I think the students at most of these institutions are even better. I spent 2 years doing research at Harvard, and certainly some of the professors impressed me, but the students impressed me even more. There are very few who are carried away by my lectures, but I tend to be carried away myself. So that's why it's so wonderful to have this clock right in front of me, so I know exactly for how long I've been going on. I will be talking a bit about the past of the transatlantic relationship, about the present, and about the future. But I warn you, I am a professor of history, and we make predictions about the past. It is very difficult to make predictions about the future, and even the best of us make serious mistakes when we try. I am reminded of my friend Paul Kennedy, who has written many excellent books, one that sold 3 million copies, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, where he predicted the fall of the United States, and no sooner was the book out than the Soviet Union collapsed. Then he wrote another one, preparing for the 21st century, and there he predicted that the 21st century belonged to Japan. And no sooner was the book out than Japan went into a political and economic crisis, and there they still are, and nobody thinks that the 21st century belongs to Japan anymore. And I thought for many years that my crystal ball was clearer than the crystal ball of anybody else. But as more and more of my predictions were published and journalists actually paid attention, and they would call me up, "Didn't you say that?" Well, I did say, I do not claim to have a particularly clear crystal ball. There is this impression that transatlantic relations had its golden years during the Cold War. That may possibly be true, but if we, by golden years, mean an absence of crisis, we are certainly wrong. Because it seems that in virtually every year, there was a crisis, and some of them very serious. Let me run through the history, which I deal with in much larger detail in my new book. I mean, after the Second World War, the very close nuclear relationship, wartime nuclear relationship between the United States and Britain was ended unilaterally by Britain. That was seen as very serious. Then there was the very tough negotiations about the American-British loan, and Washington was not seen as anything like as generous as the British government had hoped. Then came the Marshall Plan, and the Americans said that they would offer only friendly advice, but when they saw what the Europeans came up with, they were very frustrated, and they put on considerable pressure because they wanted the Europeans to do much more in the way of integration. But they were left largely disappointed. Then came NATO, which, contrary to what virtually every American historian believes, was very much of a European initiative, and it was particularly the initiative of the British and Foreign Secretary Ernest Bevin. And the Americans said that they will not participate in an Atlantic Security Organization. This was the answer in late 47, early 1948. And he said to Bevin, "You Europeans, just go ahead, form your own European Security Organization." This became the Brussels Pact, and we will see what we will do. And only in March 1948 did the Americans change attitude and agree to negotiate an Atlantic organization. But then the big question was, how was the American guarantee to Europe to be phrased? This was a very difficult issue. Took tough negotiations to get over this. No sooner was NATO formed then the question of German rearmament came up. Again, a most tricky question. The Americans had their solution, the French had their solution in the form of European army, and the Truman administration, and even more the Eisenhower administration, did go along with a version of the French suggestion. But in 1954, the French, in a way, rejected the plan they had proposed themselves. And Anthony Eden saved the day, and West Germany was brought into NATO. No sooner was that crisis ended, when we had Suez, 1956, when the United States, in a most explicit way, put maybe its two main allies, Britain and France, in place. And this incident cast a very long shadow into the future, and it led to the British conclusion that never again would we do such a thing. Never again, on an important issue, would we face the direct opposition of the United States. And we see the aftermath of that today. The French, of course, drew a different conclusion, that it had to rely more on European integration, and the Europeans had to cooperate more, and they had to become less dependent on the Americans. And when Eden made that call to Guy Mollet, Adenauer was in the room, and Guy Mollet and Adenauer, they shared this conclusion. Along came General de Gaulle in 1958, and while the Americans were positive to de Gaulle in the first few years, they soon changed their opinion. And there were several crises, and the most important ones occurred in 1963, when the general said no to British membership in the EEC, and even more important, the conclusion of the French-German treaty, which produced a crisis in Washington. The Kennedy administration panicked because they saw the Germans as siding with the French, and the two of them possibly approaching Moscow. This was faulty intelligence, but it was still a very deep crisis until the Germans were, in a way, put in their place. Then de Gaulle left the military organization of NATO. The Vietnam War produced considerable friction between the United States and most European countries. The Nixon-Kissinger team wanted to repair relations with Europe in 1973, and they proposed the Year of Europe. Everything was going to be put right. Everything was put wrong, because almost everything went wrong. It did not improve relations. There was the crisis over the Middle East, over the oil question. There was Watergate. There was superpower detente. Again, a very difficult period, or very difficult years. Along came Jimmy Carter with the best of intentions. He would put things right. After some years, when Nixon-Kissinger had focused on the Soviet Union and China, he would focus on Allied relations. The neutron bomb. The question of deployment of the neutron bomb in Europe was the most difficult issue, created new problems, and it created a particular bitterness between Carter and Helmut Schmidt, and I have met both of them fairly recently, and I can confirm that that bitterness still lingers on. In 79, there was the double-track decision on INF deployment in Europe. Not a very happy period. Ronald Reagan, well, in his first few years, he was just too firm. And everybody in Europe, including Margaret Thatcher, felt that on certain issues, particularly economic contacts and the pipeline issue, the Reagan administration was just way too tough. Then Reagan changed tack, and he became very friendly to Gorbachev. Then the Europeans felt that, no, now he's going too far in the other direction. Margaret felt that there was the risk of Ronny actually giving away the store. There was Reykjavik, where he apparently was prepared to end strategic nuclear weapons, and possibly nuclear weapons in general, to the consternation of virtually all of his advisors, and particularly Margaret Thatcher, who of course flew to Washington to tell him what needed to be done. And the French, they feared another Yalta, where allegedly there were three at Yalta. As Abraham Harriman said, the only thing that's true with the French version of Yalta is that the French were not there themselves. But there was the French fear that the two superpowers would negotiate and make a deal over the head of the Europeans. And when Reagan and Gorbachev became so friendly, the fear of Yalta was reawakened. George Bush, senior, he tried to repair some of these relations. But then German unification came up. And this was a very difficult issue again. As Mitterrand and Thatcher said, in times of crisis, the two of us should get together. And they did get together, but there wasn't much they could do. They had absolutely no alternative to what Helmut Kohl and George Bush had agreed on, and, or even more important, what the East German population wanted to see done. Bill Clinton. These were allegedly the happy days, at least compared to what we're seeing today, when everything was smooth and nice. Boy, how quickly we forget history. There was Bosnia, where the Clinton administration slowly came up with the lift and strike policy, which was contrary to what the Europeans wanted in Bosnia, and this created a crisis, a rather deep crisis in NATO, although it was put under wraps. But it was a very serious question. NATO expansion, where Bill Clinton decided virtually everything, first partnership for peace, then membership in NATO, and then only three new members, and most of the Europeans virtually sat there and took notes, but they disliked the rather firm American leadership. And Kyoto, of course, was killed under Clinton, not under Bush. The International Criminal Court, Clinton signed on his very last day in office. He knew that the ICC was going absolutely nowhere, but this was his gesture to his successor. And the landmine treaty, again, it was Clinton who didn't sign on. Clinton started out talking about assertive multilateralism. You had to put assertive in there, but still multilateralism. But they ended up talking about multilateral when we can and unilateral when we must. So it would seem there has always been a crisis in the Atlantic relationship, and some of these crises have been rather serious. And then the question is what we're seeing today, is that just another crisis which will be remembered, at least by historians, but will generally fade away? Or is this much deeper, more structural? Well, I think the answer is pretty obvious by the way in which I put the question. But the answer is far from evident. I think we should remember what happened to Paul Kennedy and what has happened to other historians who have gone out on this limb. Well, he sold 3 million copies, so there's compensation in that, of course. I think this crisis is more structural. It is deeper. And I will give 8 reasons for this. And the 3 first ones are the most important ones. The first one is that the Cold War is over. And there is no new threat which unifies the two sides of the Atlantic. Despite the disagreements during the Cold War, there was a common framework within which the Americans and the Europeans reacted. And the basis of this was the famous statement, or the alleged statement by Lord Ismay, because I don't think anybody has been able to find the quotation, but it has been attributed to him. NATO was founded to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. And there was broad agreement on this. Of course, there could be nuances in the perception of the Soviet Union, but on the whole, there was basic agreement on these 3 points. And this was the basis of the relationship. Now the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union is gone. And we read in NATO communiques and in other places that terrorism and weapons of mass destruction is the new common basis. Only to some extent. Because September 11 is a very important date in American history. It is a less important date in European history, and many Europeans have already forgotten about it. And if you look at polls, and there are tons and tons of polls that have been published in recent years, the one that's really most important was the one that told us that in 8 important European countries, 55% of the population, this is an average, thought that September 11 should at least in part be blamed on the Americans. And that points to a very, very significant difference. I don't think many in America thinks that September 11 should be attributed to the actions of the United States. Then there is the growth in American unilateralism. America has always been unilateral. America is founded on a unilateral vision that America has this very special mission and it is exceptional. But for many years, this unilateralism was combined with weakness and resulted in isolationism. That America was so special and it had to isolate itself from the old and wicked European powers. After World War II, this changed, but of course the element of strength is more predominant now in this unilateralism than ever before. America's military position is unique, and it has never been stronger after 45, after the collapse of the Soviet Union and the Red Army. And American defense spending is increasing rapidly. The increase in yearly defense spending is larger than the entire defense budget of either Britain or France. And America went through a very significant economic transformation in the 1990s, and although some of the luster is gone after Enron and WorldCom and other scandals, there is still considerable confidence in the American economy, and particularly in the growth in productivity. So unilateralism is combined with great strength. It is also combined with a reaction to globalization. I mean, for small countries like the Scandinavian ones, we have always been part of globalization. It took longer for the bigger ones, and it took particularly long for the United States. But now even the United States is greatly affected by globalization, and it is reacting in some ways rather negatively. Americans do not quite understand why, when it is so powerful, that it has to relate to all these foreign initiatives. I mean, Kyoto telling them how much they should drive their cars, and the ICC risking American soldiers and politicians being brought before an international criminal court, and they don't like it. September 11 considerably strengthened this unilateralism. And there is also, finally, a Republican dimension in this. The Republicans captured control of Congress in 1994 and the presidency in 2000. And they are more unilateralists than the Democrats, except on the free trade issue, although the Republican performance there has been disappointing. But on most other issues, the Republicans are more nationalist, more unilateralist than the Democrats. But we just have to look back at history. There were very significant differences, although under these Democratic administrations, and this was all before September 11. We tend to think that all the changes have been on the American side, and that's why the relationship is so strained. No, there have been very significant changes also on the European side, particularly in France and Germany. If we look at long-term French policy, we see that since 1919, the French have consistently sought an American security guarantee. They didn't get it in the interwar years because America withdrew, but they did get it through NATO. And this security guarantee was very important to the French, also to de Gaulle. I had the personal pleasure of meeting Chevènement, the defense minister, a rather socialist defense minister, who resigned in 1991 over the Gulf War, and he gave the typical French speech went on endlessly about Europe having to become more independent and creating its own identity. And I asked him afterwards, does this mean that you do not want the American atomic guarantee and you don't want the American troops in Europe? He gave a very honest answer. Of course we want the nuclear guarantee, and of course we want the American troops in Europe. And as long as they were stationed in Germany, it didn't matter that there were no American troops in France. I mean, this is the key. And I'm amazed that some of the French historians who have studied De Gaulle, they haven't really dealt with the question of what kind of relationship did De Gaulle actually want with the Americans. Because to some extent he was a free rider. With the American troops in Germany, there was no risk in throwing them out of France. And because France wanted this guarantee, they did actually side with the United States in virtually every serious Cold War crisis. Ultimately, it did. The Berlin crisis, the Cuban Missile Crisis, to some extent Afghanistan and Poland, the Iraq War. And everybody kind of expected that France would ultimately, in the Security Council over Iraq, give in. Because that was the rational calculation based on what they had done in the past. This did not happen. France became the leader of the opposition to the United States, something which is dramatically new. And Russia and China could hide behind France. A dramatic reversal. The change was even more, so I think it seems like the French have abandoned a policy which they have been pursuing more or less since 1919. The final answer is probably not in yet, but it looks like it. The change is also dramatic in Germany. Consider Germany's position during the Cold War. Germany was divided. The Red Army was stationed in East Germany. It was surrounded on the eastern side by hostile countries. Now Germany is unified. The Red Army is gone. It is surrounded by friendly countries, and they virtually all want to get into the European Union. During the Cold War, the situation I just described automatically put West Germany in place. It was entirely dependent on the American security guarantee, and in every serious crisis, it would side with the United States and not with France when it had a choice. This is the past. This is gone. And Germany's policy may go back and forth a bit, but this dramatic situation, which we saw during the Cold War, will not come back, and it gives Germany dramatic new freedom. Then there's the European Union. Well, I'm an historian, so I'm a very patient man. I'm not a journalist or an American. I mean, these are the impatient people. And in a long-term perspective, the European Union has been a dramatic success. The EU has been able to combine geographical widening with a deepening of content, from the 6 to the 9 to the 12 to the 15 to the 25, from the coal and steel community to the Treaty of Rome to the single integrated market to the Economic and Monetary Union. And now they are working, I have to say they because Norway is on the outside, they are working on a security and defense policy. It will take time, but there, significant steps have already been taken. I mean, there's considerable agreement on, obviously, on foreign economic trade. They have to agree. They coordinate development assistance to a large extent. crisis management as well. They have hammered out fairly joint positions on even the Middle East. And slowly, they are trying to do something on the security and defense front. This will take time. And because it will take time, this will also slow down the pace of this transatlantic drift, which I am describing in the book. There is no joint European position on important security and defense issues. And there's very little willingness to contribute to an increase in defense spending. There are still 100,000 American soldiers in Europe, most of them in Germany. And there is absolutely no desire in Germany to see them go. As a matter of fact, they protest when Pentagon develops plans to move them to Bulgaria or Romania, which would be closer to the trouble spots. So Europe is still dependent on the Americans. And there can be no true independence when you have 100,000 American soldiers still stationed in Europe. These, I think, are the three most important factors. But let me run through the other five a bit more quickly. The fourth one is the out-of-area issue. In the history of NATO, the closeness of the Atlantic relationship was based on agreement on the situation in Europe. America and many of the European countries almost consistently disagreed on out-of-area issues. They were difficult. Suez, Vietnam are two of the primary examples. Well, in the strategy debate in the 1990s, this whole concept of out-of-area was blurred. The Americans wanted to make NATO, into a global organization and get away from the European focus. They succeeded only in part, because in the 1999 definition, NATO was to deal with the Euro-Atlantic area. But this is the big debate now. Europe is stabilized. All the new trouble spots are out of the traditional NATO area, and although the Europeans are trying to adjust to this and has adjusted fairly well in Afghanistan, I think this will be very difficult in the future, because Europe was easy, these new trouble spots will be more difficult. Then we come to the redefinition of the relationship. Many initiatives have been taken on the European side, but particularly on the American side, to redefine the basic relationship between the United States and Western Europe. As Western Europe became more integrated, and as Western Europe prospered economically. I mean, starting with Kennedy's famous speech in Philadelphia in July 1962. But very little happened with these redefinitions. America remained the leader of NATO, and it insisted on being the leader. The Europeans insisted on more influence. They did get a bit more influence, but this debate is bound to come back, and we see it time and again, the Europeans insisting on more influence, and the Americans on the Europeans strengthening their military capabilities. And underlying this whole issue is the question of how will the United States respond to a Europe that is more the equal of the United States? It will not become the equal of the United States, but it will become more equal. We hear frequently from the American side that this is what they want, a Europe that is closely integrated and more a partner for the United States. But I think the answer to this question is no. This will not lead to a better relationship. it will most likely lead to further conflict. It is true that the United States has on the whole favored European integration, and in some decades pushed for European integration much more than the Europeans did themselves, but there was always one assumption, that the European integration would take place within an Atlantic framework. And this, of course, is code for American leadership. I think when this American leadership is not fully accepted, then we have seen already, I mean, during Nixon-Kissinger, and we're seeing today, a lack of interest in European integration. Now the talk is about disaggregating Europe. And I think there's probably also a lesson here in the special relationship between the United States and Britain. There was no special relationship until after World War II, when there was no doubt who was the senior partner and who was the junior partner. Before World War II, when the two were a bit more equal, there was no special relationship. We come then to the economic disputes. And we read about this in the papers, an endless number of new disputes. I mean, steel, many aspects of the common agricultural policy, hormone-treated beef, genetically modified products, steel, well, aircraft engines, an endless series. And these are important, and they are bound to affect the overall relationship. I mean, during the Cold War, the ministers of agriculture or whatever, they would be put in place by their presidents and prime ministers, and they would say that, well, we cannot really have a major transatlantic feud over beef or whatever issue there was, because the basic relationship is so important. Now the ministers of agriculture or whatever, they are not reined in the same way, and these disputes continue on and on. And there are new dimensions which flow from the further integration of the economies on both sides. I mean, antitrust legislation, for instance. Tax legislation. Still, I do not think that the economic dimension will be the crucial one, because I think it is understood on both sides of the Atlantic, not only by the political leaders, but even more by the economic leaders, that there is a very, very important, crucial Atlantic economy. I mean, all the big American companies are in Europe, and all the major European companies are in the United States, and they understand the importance of the overall market. So I think this will keep these disputes within certain limits, but they are bound to affect the overall climate. We are also seeing cultural disputes, and this is somewhat new. I mean, in Europe, we hear a lot of criticism of the Americans. They are, aren't they rather uncivilized people? I mean, they have the death penalty, and they don't want to support international law, and they are terrible polluters, and they don't maintain the infrastructure of their cities, and they have only one god, which is Mammon. On the American side, they do have a response. I mean, they tell us that, well, if you're so very sophisticated and so wonderful people, then why do you send your best students, well, some go to LSE, of course, but why do you send your best students to America? And why do you even send some of your best teachers to America? And why are our symphony orchestras and our authors having such success also in Europe? Well, some of them are more popular in Europe than they are in America. And if you are such wonderful people, why do you still need 100,000 American soldiers on European soil? Well, these are caricatures, but it is a new dimension to the transatlantic dispute. But again, I do not think this will be very important, because I think there is agreement on the overriding points. We are all part of an Atlantic culture of mass consumption, and the new dimension is really how the Europeans have been able to contribute more and more to this Atlantic mass consumption culture. I mean, British music and certain other things used to be the main contribution from the European side to America. We got all these things from America. Only Britain seemed to be able to export something in return. But lo and behold, when the Europeans finally did learn commercial television, they developed all these wonderful concepts. What are they called? I mean, Survivor, Temptation Island, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? I mean, this is the sophisticated Europeans who have developed these and exported them to America. So I think there is indeed still high consumption, popular mass culture, and there is democracy, and there is the free market, and there is also a significant religious dimension, which is rarely talked about, but it is still there. Finally, there are demographic changes, particularly in the United States. In 1970, the Northeast and the Midwest had 8 million more inhabitants than the South and the West. 10 years later, the South and the West had 10 million more than the Northeast and the Midwest. And today, there are 50 million more in the South and West. And this is having an immediate impact on politics in the United States. While the Northeast and the Midwest used to dominate American politics in the 20th century, the last president coming from these two traditional areas, elected president, was John F. Kennedy. Well, there was Gerald Ford, but he was elected only by Richard Nixon, so I think we can forget about him. All the later presidents have come from the South and West. And although the Pacific coast, I mean California, well, we know about the intricacies of California politics. We have just witnessed a marvelous example of that. So California is special, and state of Oregon and Washington, they are fairly liberal. But the rest, the Mountain West and the South, they are conservative, nationalist, and militarist. And this is certainly affecting American politics very dramatically. I mean, we may have difficulties appreciating George W. Bush when he delivers his dead or alive statements. But he is definitely understood in the South and in the Mountain West. And what were their names? I mean, these liberal Democrats? Wasn't it Humphrey and Mondale and McGovern and Dukakis? They all went down to defeat, and they will never come back. They will never come back. For very special reasons, the South did not really exert its influence for many decades, but now the South is, in a way, the dominant region. Nobody can risk giving up the South. And Al Gore, well, he did well. He did get more popular votes than George W., but he could not even win his home state of Tennessee because he was too liberal. There is a lesson there. America has also is becoming less of a European country than it used to be. It may not sound like much, but to us historians, this is very significant, because the European population, the percentage of the American population being of European ancestry, then we rule out the Hispanics, which maybe we shouldn't do, but if we do that, is going down by almost 1 percentage point per year. And now it's down to 67%. So the American population is 2/3 of European ancestry, but it's rapidly going down. Hawaii, of course, has always been a non-European state, but now California The Europeans are in a minority in California, and there will be, this will happen in other states as well. And it's bound to have an impact. I mean, I don't believe in one-factor explanations, so not any single factor will explain everything, but they all add up. This demographic development is to some extent counterbalanced by what we're seeing in Europe. And we have not fully taken this into account. The Central and Eastern Europeans, they are becoming members of NATO, and they are becoming members of EU, and they will, of course, have significant influence. And they, most of them, not all of them, did actually sign up with a British position on Iraq, but some of them more solidly than others. And Poland is the prime example, by far the biggest country, and also the most American-oriented one. Some of the others are less clear-cut in their orientation, but they are bound to slow down this process of transatlantic drift because they do want the American security guarantee. They know that Russia will come back sometime, and then America will be in place. They want the American investment. They want the Western or American mass consumption culture. So, my conclusion is that there's already been transatlantic drift. There was transatlantic drift even before the Iraq War. The Iraq War has speeded up the process. There are certain elements that will keep this dispute within boundaries, and the Europeans are divided, and that will, of course, also help the American case, so to speak. But the drift is there. How far it will go, I don't know. As I said at the beginning, my crystal ball is not particularly clear. And it isn't true that history repeats itself. Historians repeat themselves, but that is not quite the same phenomenon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Guy. We have about 20 minutes for questions, contributions, relatively short ones. So could I take the first from the floor? There are people wandering around with what look like microphones in their hands. Yes, they are microphones. So could I take the first question from the floor, please? Is there a hand going up? Can I see one?
That one.
Oh, there must be one. There's a very large hand gone up here, yeah. And there's a very large microphone. Yeah, please, go ahead.
I would just like to ask, especially regarding your last observation, when you brought in the case of the Eastern Europe. On the other side, how do you think the peripheral American countries, because I refuse to call the entire continent a country, like the entire continent, I'm Brazilian, I think I'm as American, the Americans are anyway. So how do you think the participation of the other side in this new transatlantic order should be, or if there is going to be somehow?
You mean the rest of the Americas?
Yeah.
That's a difficult question, and it's a question I have not really written much about in the book. But I think
you don't have to answer it
then. America, or the United States, we should say, will be forced to pay more attention to the Western or the rest of the Western Hemisphere. It always says that it will. And I think George Bush wanted to give a signal of what was to come when he had his first two meetings, I mean, with President Fox of Mexico, and then he went to Canada. So, I mean, these were his first two meetings. And I think it was a signal that more attention would be paid to the Western Hemisphere. But this has not really been followed up. And this is what had happened in previous administrations as well. There have been these words at the beginning, but then less action, in part because the difficult issues are elsewhere, and any administration in Washington will be crisis-driven, and very few of these crises are in the Western Hemisphere. But there are certain underlying trends which will strengthen the importance of the rest of the Western Hemisphere, and immigration is one of them. Two-fifths of immigration to the United States is from the Western Hemisphere, and the Hispanics are now the largest minority in the U.S. There are more Hispanics than there are blacks. And once they get better organized and stronger financially, we will see their influence in U.S. politics grow. And this is bound to have an impact.
Okay, thanks, guys. A number of hands gone up. I've got a hand over here. This is, I think, Michael Dunn from University of Sussex. You are the same Michael Dunn, I think, yes?
I'm the same Michael Dunn, but not at the University of Sussex.
Oh, you're very right.
I did enjoy your talk, a mixture of the empirical and the extrapolation, so may I congratulate you. Would you just like to say a little bit about the so-called special relationship and how you see the position of the United Kingdom in this transatlantic drift?
Well, I mean, isn't there a saying in English saying that this would be like carrying coal to Newcastle? That I am to address the special relationship here.
Where else?
Where everybody in the audience, not everybody, but many in the audience will know much about more about this than I will. Well, I think there has been a special relationship. And they are wrong, those in Britain, and there are quite a few of the historians who deny that there is a special relationship. I think it's so obvious. I mean, any outsider, an outsider historian, will immediately conclude there is indeed a special relationship between the United States and Britain. This is on the nuclear side, on the intelligence side, on the naval side. I mean, you can mention area after area where there's such a special relationship. And as I said in my lecture, I think Suez convinced British politicians that you should do whatever you can to maintain this special relationship. I think it's wrong, those who conclude that Britain or Tony Blair is just the poodle of George Bush. I mean, I think this is absolutely wrong. And I think it's we are beginning to get information on this point, what Tony Blair was actually thinking during the Iraq War. There is the new book by, what's his name, Peter Sotheby. And there, it's quite clear that Blair thought that a United States that went to war alone and was victorious alone, that this situation would have very dramatic consequences, and this kind of tactical reason was part of Tony Blair's reasoning. And they do, of course, agree on many issues, and I think Blair had hoped that he could have some influence on the Americans on these other issues, particularly the Middle East, where the American and British approach are very different indeed. What Britain has been able to get from this special relationship? Well, that's a difficult question, probably less than expected, but much of this is still hidden. I think it has been able to get an awful lot on the nuclear side. It has been able to get an awful lot on the intelligence side, and there have been the crises. We just have to mention the Falklands, whether we think the British response appropriate or not is not the issue. But Britain has been able to get quite a few things from the United States. And how this kind of weighs up, I don't know. But we also see clearly that Tony Blair is maneuvering under a great difficulty. He agrees with the French that European capabilities must be strengthened. And this is really not very controversial vis-a-vis the Americans. They also want to strengthen European capabilities. But certain things could flow from this. There was Saint-Malo in December 98, and there are the talks that have been going on more recently. I think there is a substantial pressure within the EU in the direction of working something out, in strengthening the European dimension. And Tony Blair does in part agree with this, and there will be this constant influence, primarily from France and Germany, but also from others, to produce a new form of European unity, and this is bound to have its consequences. And it will add up. It will add up. And this, too, will affect the transatlantic relationship. But the British hesitancy and the support for the British position in other countries will slow down this process a great deal. This was not very emphatic, but it's very difficult to speak in emphatic terms about this issue.
Thanks very much. Got another question here from Robert Hunter-Wade at the LSE. Yeah, Robert.
If you were a European political leader, would you be giving much higher priority than is being given now to building up collaborating, cooperating, coordinating relations between Europe and East Asia, led by China and Japan, in matters of foreign policy, economic policy, and so on, and defense policy, on the grounds that that Europe and East Asia on their own, independently, would not be able to balance the US, but acting together coordinatedly, they may be able to balance the US, and that a more multipolar world resulting from that is a better world than the present unipolar world?
Well, I am not a political leader, and that's I think that's well, that's a blessing for me, and it's a blessing for Norway. I can basically speak my mind, but I think we see very clearly illustrated the limitations in European power when you address East Asia, because Europe is, or the EU is, very significant in economic terms in East Asia, but it is not really a significant political or military player. It has no importance in an issue like North Korea. Other powers deal with this, and it's a very significant issue. So I think the kind of calculation that you are referring to, it is beyond the imagination of most serious European politicians. And again, we see how important the United States is for China. It seemed that there would be a hostile relationship between the United States and China under Bush. I mean, they, in the early days of the Bush administration, China was one of the three major threats to the US. No more. They are cooperating rather well, the American-Chinese relationship is rather good, and that argues very strongly against the kind of scenario which you developed. And I think this is the kind of scenario that we academics like to speculate about, but it's beyond the horizon for the politicians. They have more immediate things to deal with.
Okay, I've got two or three. I've got Chris Hill here. And if you could bring the microphone to the person, I'll take, yeah, you got it. Okay, Chris.
Thank you very much. Two points. Of course, looked at from outside the transatlantic common culture, things might look rather different, not just to very radical elements like Al-Qaeda, but plenty of people would say, well, this is part of a common world playing hard man, soft man, division of labor or whatever. I mean, the Europeans going to Iran and trying to get the Iranians to play ball over nuclear weapons and so on. That's something the United States is not necessarily going to be deeply unhappy about. It's just a question of tactics. So perhaps you'd address that question, whether indeed the drift really matters very much when looked at from an outside or a global perspective. The second point is about institutions. How much do institutions matter in all this? It's almost the obverse of the first point. On the one hand, we've got a European convention, which is apparently going to produce new institutions to enable the Europeans to speak more effectively to the Americans, paradoxically, with a single foreign minister or a president or whatever, in order to give European foreign policy some greater institutional structure. And on the other hand, as soon as there's talk of a crisis, there's a huge transatlantic reaction with endless visits, seminars, trilateralism, transatlantic business dialogue, you know, you name it, it's there. There is an equal and countervailing reaction. Do these things matter?
Guy, can I take just another
sure.
question? Just add this
yes, these were the difficult questions. I have to think more about them.
I'll
please take a few
ones
more.
Later on, it's okay. I have an impossible one now, yeah. Yeah, please.
Okay, thank you. I would like to ask you, just to be very briefly, in reality, I would like to know what it could be the problem, the conflict that Latin America, the situation in Latin America creates for transatlantic. The point that I'm making is that European position regarding drug trafficking and also internal conflicts, and just thinking about intervention, is very different than the American one. And now you were mentioning that the Hispanic population in the States is increasing, so therefore might be a different perspective right now.
There you go. There's a couple there to go. And we've got a couple more questions and then we bring it to a conclusion. Guy, do you want to take some of those on?
Well, these were difficult questions. So,
well, don't answer them then. You know, I mean, just play the old academic trick.
I know you will all be unhappy if I don't try to address them. So,
no, not at all.
I think on the cultural side, it's important. We don't talk about this. But I think the rising Islamic or fundamentalist threat is serving to bring the United States and Europe closer together than they would otherwise have been. I mean, the discussion about China is less relevant, but I think this is more relevant, but it will not be openly talked about. But it contributes to the relative cultural agreement. Different tactics, yes. And there are some in Europe who argue that the Americans should deal with the military issues and we should deal with the political and economic issues. I think that is bound to lead to more crisis. You cannot have that kind of division. Both sides have to contribute in all dimensions. And I'm not entirely convinced by the European argument, which was there's no European argument because the Europeans are divided. But over Iraq, those Europeans who played down the crisis, they may have been right because, there was no terrorist link to Saddam Hussein and there were no weapons of mass destruction. And the conclusion then is that you don't really need this military dimension. I think that's wrong. And we should not forget Bosnia and Kosovo, which they were European crisis. And I think it had to be admitted in France, in Britain, in many other countries, that you do indeed need a stronger European military. And you cannot leave this entirely to the Americans. Institutions, yes, institutions are important. I thought that indirectly, one of my contributions was that I played down the personal dimension. Because we all the time we hear, this is what we read in newspapers, even sophisticated newspapers, that if only George Bush would disappear, then everything would be wonderful. I mean, we remember the same thing from Ronald Reagan. If we only could get rid of Ronald Reagan. I wrote an article with that title, If We Could Only Get Rid of Ronald Reagan. And the American Embassy in Oslo, they called me and said, well, do you have plans to do anything about this? I think we overstate the personal dimension. Personalities are important, but I, relatively speaking, I did play them down. Countervailing pressures, yes, there are countervailing pressures, and we see them today. France, and particularly Germany, are trying to move closer to the United States. There are these efforts to paper over the disagreement, but they are not entirely successful. And I think the kind of underlying factors which I try to point to, they are bound to be crucial. I mean, just what has happened in Germany's position. I mean, think of the Iron Curtain, the Red Army, all that is gone, and it gives Germany an entirely different sort of freedom. So there are indeed underlying strategic factors. Not all the eight factors are structural, but they are. Some of them are clearly structural, and others are relatively structural. Drug trafficking, I don't know too much about that. But again, it would seem that there is only a time difference between what is going on in the United States and Europe. Obviously, drugs are a huge problem in the United States, but it is certainly becoming a big problem in Europe too. And I don't see this, well, the approaches are somewhat different, but I don't see this as a particularly divisive issue between the United States and European countries.
Okay, I'm just going to take two more, and I'm going to take them both from the balcony because I don't want to be accused of balconism. So there's somebody up here who's got the microphone?
Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm here.
All right, there you are. You've got the microphone, good. And there's somebody back up there? There's some chap in the middle here, yeah. Give him a microphone. These will be the last two. Right, because we're moving on, and I've got a nice announcement to make for all of you people. There may be a free drink afterwards. So anybody who left, please come back in. Right, there's somebody here, right.
I wanted to ask you if you would please comment on the current situation in Iraq and how would the future development of Iraq possibly affect transatlantic relations.
And was there somebody in the middle here? Doesn't have the mic. Okay, speak into the mic. Thank you. And we'll make this the last, because we're really running out of time. I know there's lots of other people. Please.
Don't you think that Europe needs to be more strong, needs to have an army, and the Americans to see that, that Europe is strong, there is no one saying anything against, and don't you think that the UK is breaking that rule, saying, well, let's go with Americans? So until the Americans see that Europe is united with every, they will maintain, and they will not go in not many wars as they are going now.
Okay, that's a loaded question for you, guy. Okay, two questions. We'll have to call that to an end.
Okay, on Iraq, it seems that politically almost everything has gone wrong for the United States. They thought that France would in the end give up. It didn't. It also miscalculated the reaction of Russia and China. And it miscalculated the reaction of Turkey. They thought the Turks would be part of an invasion, and they weren't. Even more seriously, they miscalculated what would happen in Iraq once there was military victory. The conservatives, it's a wrong word, because some of them are actually revolutionaries in Washington. Revolutionaries thought that once you had removed Saddam Hussein, there would be harmony. And clearly, this has not happened. I mean, Iraq was no tabula rasa on which the Americans could then leave their imprint. So much has gone wrong. Almost everything has gone wrong politically, it seems. But the United States is so strong militarily that at least for a while, it seemed that these political calculations didn't matter. It had quick victory, and it was a very impressive military performance. I think it's too early to decide that the Americans will fail in Iraq. There are these polls that seem to indicate that there is considerable sympathy for the United States, even with the majority of the Iraqis, particularly in the north and in the south. But clearly, the present situation cannot continue for very long. And well, we again, I give up. My crystal ball is not that clear. And what will be the outcome of this, I don't know. But I think it would be a very, very dramatic defeat if the United States were simply to give up and pull out. And they are far from there. And they do not even want to make very significant concessions to others to bring them into Iraq. Their response is that we should train more Iraqis much faster. And they hope that this will do the trick. Well, we'll see. We'll see. European army. Well, I think in the 50s, there was actually talk about a European army with a European defense minister. I mean, what we're talking about today is not a European army, but we are talking about national contributions which can in some way be coordinated. And we see that this is happening. It may not look like much, but there is Macedonia. There is the Congo. And there will probably be Bosnia. And I think these are maybe small things, but they are a signal of what is to come. But we are far from able in Europe to deal with the Bosnia and Kosovo. And I met some time ago the former deputy SACEUR in NATO, Sir Rupert Smith. And he had been in charge of coordinating the European effort on the military side. And he said that, well, there have been words and words and words, but nothing has really happened on the military side. And that is to some extent recognized, and that is why Europeans, most of them in the very back of their heads, still realize that you need the Americans, and that puts a limit to the kind of process I have been talking about.
Thank you very much, Guy. I'm going to draw the proceedings to a conclusion for a variety of reasons. One is there's going to be a reception upstairs to which you're all invited. There is a free drink, so please don't come. I was told by one of the organisers in the wonderful events department here at the LSE that this hall holds 449 people. By my calculation, we had 446 here today. So that, I think, attests to the power of the speaker and his reputation, and I hope also to the subject. I would like to thank, apart from thanking Guy, which I will do in a moment, I'd like to thank the Association of Norwegian Students Abroad. I never knew such a thing existed, but I now know because I can hear the protests from all my Norwegian friends and students. But do thank you very much for your support for this. This has been an Anglo-Norwegian effort. Let's put it like that in the best sense of the word. And perhaps the Christmas tree might come back to Trafalgar Square, which I'm told is now supposed to be politically rather incorrect or something. But anyway, that's another issue. You are all invited. When Margot told me I could invite you all for a free drink upstairs, I didn't know if I was going mad or Margot was. But anyway, you're all invited to a drink at a reception on the fifth floor of this building in the senior common room. There will be the normal statutory warm glass of red wine and even warmer glass of cold wine. But please come up and speak to Guy, who will reveal all the secrets of the Nobel Committee.
Yes.
I do not think. Anyway, finally, to thank our speaker. Wise, witty, good judgment as always. I also discovered one thing about Guy. He has much in common with our own Professor Chris Hill in the Department of International Relations. They are the only two people in this hall who support Wolverhampton Wanderers. However, I think I got that right. But anyway, congratulations to both of you. It's nice to have minority interest at the LSE, as well as big speakers on big topics. With no more to thank Guy for a fantastic presentation. We hope you come back again, Guy, and tell us more in a year's time. We'll predict it to you. You're bound to have got it all right tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming, and I would like to enlighten you on one point. Wolverhampton Wanderers has one additional supporter, and I think we should think of her. This is the Nobel Peace Prize laureate of 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma.
So there's a reception upstairs in the fifth, on the fifth floor in the senior current room, drinks and nibbles.